people are looking around and they're going, okay, tell me, are my children safe? Are my, you know, are the teachers, is my husband, is my wife okay? And there was no good element of communication.
Welcome to the PreparedX podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
That was part of my interview with Alan Sutherland, the CEO of Intelligent. Fascinating conversation with Alan, all around the importance of accurate data during crises or during any type of event that would impact your organization. We spoke about the criticality of managing that information during stressful and chaotic times. Alan has lots of great examples from recent and also from past events where data has been critical. Anyway, here's the rest of my interview with Alan. Good afternoon, Alan. Welcome to the PreparedX podcast.
Well, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Just before we get started, could you, for the audience, just share a little bit about your career to date, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So before founding Intelligent, I started out as an accountant, graduating as an accountant, went into business in one of the big public accounting firms, left there about 25 years ago and went to work for a major multinational corporation, creating a capital group inside, investing money that the company was making, helping customers buy equipment and so on and so forth, and had an opportunity to travel around the world and really kind of sort of get an understanding of diverse businesses and diverse people. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was at that point in time in my life where you kind of sort of figure out, okay, am I going to stay where I'm at, or am I going to go, kind of that midlife crisis point. And I had been, as we'll get into, I had been impacted, like most of us, by the events of 9/11. I was in London several years after that during the bombings, the subway bombings and the bus bombings, and to realize exactly where the deficiencies were from a preparedness and a communication standpoint. At the time, of course, I was working and couldn't kind of sort of go away and start to do better. So I was part of that chorus of people saying, gosh, there has to be a better way. Somebody's got to figure out a better solution. But I wasn't at that point. Zip forward to about 4 or 5 years ago, I then decided, hey, you know, instead of keeping working for a big corporation, eventually retire, what I'll do is I'll start up a tech company. My background had sort of helped me with business, learned a little bit about tech through the investing side, and so decided, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to really try to create a differentiating making business to help people during times of crisis. And that was the seedling behind what we created as Intelligent that we have today.
That's great. And I know towards the end of the episode today, you know, we'd like to hear a little bit more about the firm and its solutions. So we'll come on to that. But let's start off right at the very beginning. Let's start off with, you know, discussing, providing our listeners with an overview of the criticality of remaining informed prior to, during, and even after emergencies. Could you start off at that level for us?
This is something I'd be more than happy to. You know, this is just kind of sort of the core of my and our being here at Intelligent, that we just think that you need to, each one of us, we need to kind of sort of understand what's going on before, during, and after these emergencies. And we have a perfect illustration of this, which is an unfortunate perfect illustration. Almost all of these are, which is yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of the shooting down in Parkland in Southern Florida.
Yep.
And in that situation, right, what you have seen in the aftermath, and of course, in the aftermath, you're going to see all kinds of failures. There's a lot of things that broke down in kind of sort of the worst school shooting in American history, or one of the worst school shootings in American history. But one of the things that was identified was, irrespective of how many times and people had been told to prepare themselves, how many systems were being told to put in place, how much different government agencies like police departments in Broward County versus police department in Parkland were told that they needed to better communicate with each other. What they saw time and time again is that they just didn't follow through. They didn't execute on that preparedness beforehand. And so what happened was, you know, people put it off. Everybody's busy and they have a long list of things that they have to do. And it just kind of sort of kept falling to the wayside because it's not easy and it's not simple to get groups of people together and figure out a solution to a complicated challenge. So they kept being pushed off. But of course, when the event happens, then everybody is scrambling. Nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows what's going on. And then in the aftermath, of course, people are looking around and they're going, okay, tell me, are my children safe? Are my, you know, are the teachers, is my husband, is my wife okay? And there was no good element of communication. Right. Each and every one of these disasters kind of sort of falls into that. The scary part, Rob, is in Broward County, about a year before this shooting at Parkland, they had a shooting, you'll remember, at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. And yes. So it's this is one of these things, right, where you could be sitting in, you know, a paradise type location where there's never any crime and so on and so forth. And it happens and you go, oh, wow, I didn't even think about being prepared. But here was a situation where the exact same police groups had just dealt with a shooting not very long before, where people were running around the airport thinking that there were marauding bands of shooters. They were running out onto active tarmac. Things were happening and nobody knew what was going on. And so here's a group that had lived through it and hadn't taken the actions needed, hadn't prepared for the next event. I guarantee you that they're not going to let that happen again.
Right. Yep. Yeah. I mean, great examples there of recent events. So appreciate that. So in terms of organizations creating situational awareness for themselves from the very beginning of an incident, why is that really important?
It's ultimately critical. Right? The thing about having an organization going through this from a situational awareness at the very beginning is that they can create scenarios in a non-crisis environment. So one of the things that you have to worry about is you have to send out a message to somebody. And if any of us have been stressed and we're in a moment of stress and we're trying to type an email or trying to type a text message while other things are going on, while people are talking to us and so on and so forth, you know that it is very, very difficult to get it into the right format in the right way. The ability to have an appropriate chain of command that has pre-authorized certain types of communication that go out, we'll call them templates, that go out in certain points in time where people are trained routinely, no different than a police officer pulling their weapon and shooting it at the firing range. They need to know how to do that and they don't need to think about it. They need to be able to do it over and over and over again to be prepared for that moment when it happens. They hope to never do it, right? Sure. This is one of those things when you think about it, most police officers never pull their weapon during the course of their entire career. But yet every police officer goes through and prepares. In an organization, if the organization doesn't think about this, in my prior life, I was part of one of the biggest companies of the world, and I was a senior officer of one of these big companies. So that was really great. Lots of wonderful perks.
Yeah.
But one of the things that they had was, you know, they had to worry about, you know, if there was an event that somebody got mad at the company or they didn't like one of our products or they wanted to come to the corporate office or they wanted to do something or we were traveling in another country and we got kidnapped, any of these things, right? They had to prepare for it. And the organization had to think about it in advance of those events occurring, not because we truly expected those events to occur, But if the of those events occurred, we needed to know what to do. Sure. And when you're talking about active shooter, when you're talking about fire in the building, I mean, again, go back to 9/11. None of those people that were in the World Trade Center, none of them anticipated that there was going to be a plane flying into the building that day,
right,
and or the buildings that day, and that the building was then going to collapse.
Right.
I mean, so the unexpected happens. You have to prepare for it. You have to understand it. And so the organization has to kind of sort of figure that out in advance. Otherwise, if they're trying to do it on the fly, it'll never work.
Sure. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. You know, thinking back from my military days when we would exercise consistently before obviously going into battle, and, you know, but again, you know, you couldn't exercise for every conceivable situation, but you could do as many as, you know, physically possible, and then adapt to those, you know, certain situations that may go left or right. But as much preparedness as possible really helped.
That's a great illustration, Rob. And you know, I think so many instances, organizations can sort of fall away from that, and they just kind of sort of assume somebody else will handle it, or it'll never happen in their location. And, you know, that's where I think the world has evolved to. Organizations really need to, and I don't care if that's an elementary school in Southern Florida where you've got children K through eight. Why should they ever have to worry about an active shooter in the building?
Right.
But they do. And so they need to prepare, and they need to understand so that when, and they have to do that, as you pointed out. And I think one of the things that's key is at the very beginning of the incident, they have to have it figured out who's going to do what when, because just like you described, when you're going into battle, you don't need to start worrying about, okay, is this group going to the right or is this group going to the left? And how are we doing this and so on and so forth? Because you have to make sure that you're executing on the plan appropriately. And so situational awareness at the beginning is, in my opinion, kind of sort of one of the key differentiators between success and disaster.
Sure. And so let's talk about the information then. What kind of information should organizations have access to throughout the response phase of an emergency? What kind of data?
Well, we could do, I think, a podcast. So I'm sure you probably have
right.
thought about it just on that one point, right? Because it changes it changes depending on the situation. And I think that's the most difficult part of this. Let's take a potential bomb threat. So we had a situation yesterday, unfortunately, where one of the groups that was using our platform was communicating out to the field, letting them know that there was a black SUV in the area that was loaded with explosives, and it was traveling around the area trying to find a school to blow up, which this is unfortunately a true story. Now you're sitting there and you're going, okay, now from a communication standpoint, what you need to know is, or you know, a response is, you have to first understand whether it's a credible threat, whether it's not a credible threat. It's a black SUV. There's not, you know, this is you couldn't have made it more generic, right?
Yeah.
And it's driving around and looking for a school. So you're in all these instances, it was a very, very bold, broad brush situation. So now security services has to figure out, emergency services has to figure out, okay, how are we going to best figure this information out? And how are we going to assess the challenge, which is we have to get data. We have to get information to be able to process it. And we have to do that timely. We have to do that quickly. And then if we determine that there is a credible threat through this actionable intelligence, then we have to be able to identify who are the people in danger. And how do we get the information to them quickly and efficiently,
yep.
right? So at the core, now, so that's one example. A different example is a situation not too long ago in Hawaii where our missile defense system went off,
yeah.
and the person sent out a message, right? And took everybody, right? Everybody freaked out. Well, that was a false alarm. It wasn't real. It should have been a test. He sent it out as a real alert. And so it was a human error. But what ended up happening was now you've got a bunch of misinformation, a bunch of miscalculations going on, and so on and so forth. And you've got to then kind of sort of recall it, keep people, get them calm, and so on and so forth. So you've got two elements, I think, as part of this kind of what kind of information. First bit is the situational awareness to figure out, okay, is this real? What's going on? And then who do I need to notify? Who do I need to tell? And then the second part is get a message out to them quickly, efficiently, and accurately that they can rely on. So it has to be authoritative that they can rely on that tells them what to do. Yep. So, you know, those are the two aspects in my mind that are critical. And it changes kind of sort of in part depending on which type of situation you're in, right? An active shooter in the lobby, you want to make sure that the people in the building or outside the building don't go into the danger zone, but you still have to figure out, okay, what's going on and who's there. It's that first response is I've got to process and then I've got to send. And so those are the two things in my mind. You've got every kind of sort of critical or emergency situation has to go through step one to step two, analyze the information, get the information quick, analyze it. And then once you've identified that there's a true risk, that there's a big issue, then get out a message quickly to people that they can see and they can understand to cause them to be safer or to be able to react the way you want them to.
Sure. And that goes into my next question, really, in terms of the pure amount of data during these types of events. And, you know, I mean, we can use, you know, any example. You know, one example we use here in the Northeast is the Boston bombings. You know, tremendous amount of, you know, you've got a sporting, major sporting event on a holiday, which is a holiday out here. And, you know, huge amount of people and, you know, lots of information flying around in all kinds of different directions. I had a former military colleague that was on a rugby tour with his young cadet officers. And I think they just played either Harvard or MIT, I forget. And they were watching the back end of the marathon. And it unfolded, and I just happened to be on Twitter when it unfolded, and I started to see this thing unfold. And he called me, and he said he had 10 or 12 young officers. One or two had local cell phones, but everyone else, there was no one else with, you know, cell phones. So he literally didn't have access to, you know, to any information in terms of where they were. He obviously had a lot of data because they were right there by he was close enough to the finish line where I think he was between the two blasts. So, you know.
Oh, but, my.
Yeah. So let's talk. And, you know, this is a guy who'd been to, you know, a couple of tours of Afghanistan and Iraq. And here he is experiencing the same thing on the streets of Boston. So how do organizations then, in terms of managing that flow of information, how do they manage that? Because, the quantity is massive in these types of events, and even in smaller events when there's confusion and chaos, how do you recommend that organizations sift through that data?
Well, and so great question. And again, like you said, Boston bombing was, you know, horrific, right? But it, as you highlighted, it was a group of people that were just going out, having a great day on a holiday, running, kind of celebrating, going out, being for various causes. They're not anticipating that they're going to be in the middle of a bomb blast. Your mates that were coming in for rugby, they weren't anticipating that they were going to be in trouble. If you go into battle in Afghanistan, you anticipate the problem.
Right.
So, but if you go into these other situations, you don't. And so that highlights exactly what you said, which is sifting through the data, because when you're in a controlled environment where you're going into battle, for example, you know what you're doing, you know where you're going, you've got all the command center people are already focusing on everything that's going on the battlefield and around the battlefield. When you don't know where the battlefield is, it's a completely different story. And so I think that, you know, we, as you pointed out, the one thing that we have almost with us all the time is our mobile phones. They've become staples. They didn't exist. Still staggering to me to think about the fact that the true smartphone that we have today, like the iPhone and the Samsung models, those didn't exist 11 years ago, right? I mean, it's kind of sort of staggering to me how quickly we've moved, but they become our lifeline to the world. And so we have them with us all the time. That also gives us an access to an internet, and giving access to the internet means that we have all this other additional information. And there's a plus and a negative, right? The plus side of the internet is this, what we refer to as Internet of Things, where you can have cameras, you can have, I mean, you think about it, every ATM has a camera, every corner now has, in major cities, have cameras. You've got information coming in from a variety of different sources, looking through emails, looking through phone calls, looking through text messages, and so on and so forth. That all creates this kind of aggregation of information that has to be sorted through. So the benefit of being able to sort through is, in my opinion, one of the things that computers are best at, and, you know, is taking huge quantities of information and sifting them down and creating kind of sort of actionable intelligence that people can then work through. What's critical to that, though, is then also, as we were saying, not just getting that information, but getting it into the people's hands that can actually understand it and work through it, and then having them be able to figure out how they can then appropriately disseminate it out through that exact same or similar channel. So, you know, I think that the, you know, the kind of information, you know, the managing the flow, right, of data during a crisis is more too much for any human. Sure. I mean, you have to have the computers, they have to be there. We have these things that are ridiculous. We talk about our cell phones. I'm not enough of a technician to truly understand it, but everybody tells me that my cell phone has more power in it than the computers that were manning the first, you know, moon launches. So you sit there and you say, you know, with all this power in my little computer, that is my cell phone, and then the massive computers that everybody else has, the ability to create a connected world and a connected community has a scary part. And that is, we have to make sure that people's privacy is protected, but it has a truly beneficial part to society. And that is, we can allow the computers to be very, very quick and very, very good in getting that information out to people.
Yeah, and talking about that information, what, you know, what can organizations do in term, or what should they do in terms of, you know, once they gather that information, and you just, you know, in great detail there talked about, you know, how they do that, and obviously, you know, technology is, you know, first and foremost in terms of being front and center of, you know, being part of that process. But, you know, how do they decide, you know, what's critical and what's noise?
That's probably where, you know, in my opinion, you still have to bring the human into the equation. Because in order to determine what's noise and what's really critical, you have to be able to look at it and use training and use instinct and use kind of sort of all the skills. Now, maybe one day we'll have those programmed into the algorithms, but I think the concept is, let the algorithms sort through the data and present certain specific information, and then let the humans figure out the rest. So, for example, we're working with a group that is very much involved with camera facial recognition software, and that facial recognition software, most software programs can take a picture, a front-on picture of a face, and then analyze it through a database to determine if it's a bad person or not, based off the criteria in the database. This software will take a partial picture of a face and then extend it and then do something wonderful with it. Now, that's an extension of facial recognition technology that was software type, I mean, a sci-fi type stuff just a few years ago, and it's becoming reality. So that's a great use of kind of sort of the computers and the algorithms to be able to figure out kind of sort of where the bad people are and when and what they're doing, what the bad people are doing. But you still need that human, in my opinion, to be able to determine, is that really the bad guy? So start with the list of who the bad guys are, then let the computers go off and find them, or figure out whether they're actually doing something really bad. Right. Because you don't want to routinely go harass people because you don't like the way they look or the way they act or whatever the case may be. There still has to be personal freedoms. And so you need that, in my opinion, you need that human element to be able to make that decision as to, are they really doing anything, or are they just, you know, walking down the street, as the case may be, with a backpack on their shoulders.
Sure, sure. That makes sense. And you touched on it there in terms of technology, but it just, my next question here is, where's the industry going in terms of information sharing and technology in the next, you know, few years? You know, I mean, you know, my question here is 5 years, but it almost seems, you know, we have new techs popping up every week almost in this particular space. You know, technology, you know, it's a cliche, but, you know, it does, you know, it's taken over our world and it's moving, you know, almost every second at a faster pace. So where's this industry going, Alan, in your opinion?
So true. And so the first thing I say, my first kind of sort of words in the space are 5G. And I don't know if it's 5G or 6G is where it's going to get to. But 5G is such a quantum leap forward in communication as it relates to 4G, as 4G was to 3G. And sure. And if none of us really remember 3G, all you have to do is kind of sort of go to an area, an underserved area of the country, or travel internationally, and you get caught into a 3G market and your apps don't work, your phone performs inappropriately, and so on and so forth, because the data is loading so slow because everything is so data rich. Well, what the 5G environment allows us to do is it allows us to transmit data so quickly that we can now start doing some incredibly rich things, like we were talking about in facial recognition. We can transfer files that would have taken hours before in a 3G environment can be transferred in seconds in a 5G environment. And so the ability to get true situational awareness out to the people that are in the field for them to be able to figure things out. I mean, again, we're not quite into, you know, magic land of Harry Potter or any of the other, you know, kind of sort of imagery that we could imagine through a Doctor Who series. But you are in a space where you could take your device and your device could have an entire operational manual downloaded into it in seconds that you could reference, you could use hyperlinks, you could do whatever you wanted to in order to make kind of sort of a mobile command center. Yep. To give you all the functionality you would have with access to all the cameras and and being able to talk to multiple people at the same time with video links and so on and so forth in real time with high quality. And I think that's one of the keys, right? The real time high quality without any type of degradation.
Sure.
Without, you know, that's coming.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, we're seeing it today. You can do a multi-person video call on your cell phone.
Yep.
Where before, when I was kind of sort of growing up, having a video call with somebody in, you know, around the corner or in another country was a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
Incredibly expensive.
Yep.
And the quality was horrible.
Yep.
Right. Now we can do it on our phone and we don't even think twice about it.
No.
With incredible HD clarity and so on and so forth. So in my mind, kind of sort of the advent of 5G is going to push us forward. The other part that I think is critical is investment. We have, you know, it's not just public money that's going into the tech sector, right? But you have gobs and gobs of private money going into the tech sector. One of my perfect illustrations of that is Elon Musk's SpaceX company.
Yep.
And you sit there and you go, you know, when we were growing up, the only people that could ever afford to send, you know, rockets up into space carrying people were government.
Right.
And it was huge situation. Here you've got private individuals basically funding this creation of space travel. And not just with an imagery of going up out into space and coming back, but you're talking about going to other planets.
Right.
And it's at the private sector. And so you think about that and you start thinking about how much money is being raised through venture funds, through private equity funds, through what both early stage, mid stage and late stage to be able to support technologies that once we get these infrastructure items solved, these 5G items, these you know, enhanced devices like we have on our Android and iOS phones. With the proliferation, I mean, again, Apple and Google have done all the hard work with creation of the App Store and the Play Store. They have their phones in work in almost every part of the globe with almost every person on the planet. And so, you know, if you can create something that goes onto one of those devices or all of those devices, you can actually start doing something that you could never have even imagined before. And so I think if you sit there and say, what, you know, where are we going? Why are we going? Well, I think you've got, it feeds on itself. The innovation feeds on itself. So one person is building block type stuff. If I can do X, then somebody else can do Y. Somebody else can then do Y squared and so on and so forth. They need money, they need technology, and they need infrastructure. So with all the things that are moving, I can see devices with holograms, you know, popping up, telling us what to do. I can see reference materials. I can see all the things that you want. I mean, we don't, just to be clear, nobody goes out and looks at an encyclopedia anymore. They just go in and they pull up their phone and they say, Siri, tell me about this. Or Alexa, tell me, you know, play this music for me. And it just happens.
Yep.
And so I think you kind of sort of sit there and you go, where are we going to be 5 years from now? If I knew exactly which company was going to be successful, then I'd stop the call and go make a buy order.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do know that this tech machine is just, it's just getting going. There's so much money going in. There's such good infrastructure. The 5G networks will be here as a standard within that 5-year period.
Yep.
And so the amount of information that we'll be able to load into devices is going to be staggering, and that's going to change the game.
Well, fascinating. I think it's, you know, just great insight from someone who's on the very edge of all things tech within this space. So I appreciate that that comment. So as we start to wrap up, then I'd like to hear a little bit more about Intelligent and the types of services and solutions you offer to the marketplace.
Thank you. So I'll make this quick. So please stop me if I'm going too fast. But what we tried to do, going back to that 9/11 situation, is I wanted to be in a situation where if there is a crowdsourcing need from an emergency standpoint, I wanted to be able to make sure that that authority, whoever it was, building management, police, whoever, could get an information, could get a message out to those people. So remember that whole concept of you've got to have information, the smart people have to be able to evaluate the information, and then they've got to get that information out to people quickly and efficiently. So the couple things that were important that, in my opinion, were impediments to effective and quick communication is, number one, it's very, very difficult to send a message to somebody you don't know. So we needed to have an ability to crowdsource or group people based on where they are, whether they move around. So if you imagine kind of sort of circles around buildings. If you go into one building, you're connected. If you go out of the building, you're disconnected. You go into another building, you're connected. You go out of the building, you're disconnected. Kind of that whole hokey pokey music song. You step in, you're in, you're out, yeah. Step out, you're out. And so we said, we have to come up with that. We have to start a language system that says that the person, we are not a homogeneous language group anymore. And so what that means is if you send out a message in English and somebody is receiving it and they speak Polish or they speak Hebrew or they speak Spanish, you need to be able to make sure that it translates into their language without putting a burden on the issuer. So that means an automatic change to the language based on how the device is set. That allows the message to be immediately translated into, you know, kind of sort of all the common languages of the planet. So those are two things that we said had to be important and truly impediments to normal communication. But then the thing that was most critical to us is we had to be able to override silent, do not disturb, cut settings on for notifications, cut in on audio sessions, you know, be able to make sure that people notice that message. So if you think of an Amber Alert type technology, if you think about just not putting your phone on silent and going into a meeting and somebody gets a phone call, you completely understand kind of sort of why that creates an immediacy, because you have to look in order to get the message or get the phone to stop making noise. And when you look, now you can start consuming that information. And so we really had those as our three pillars. We were amazed that no one had ever been able to figure out how to override the silent or do not disturb settings on a device. And what was key was not just if the app was awake and active on the screen, but if it was minimized or if it was forced closed or if the device was asleep. Like, it had to work in all of those situations, Rob. Because if you think about it, most of the time your phone's asleep. It's not awake. And you don't keep all your apps open. So we had to figure that out. We were the first ones to figure that out. We went out and got a patent. We lived with the patent office evaluating our patent for about 3 years, which was amazingly long, but just the way their system works. When that finally came through in November, we opened up, we had linked our technology to our own application. That would be the Intelligent app, which is available on the App Store, Play Store. And we have, you know, thousands of customers. We're in the, you know, we're in 90 different countries right now. We're, you know, rocking and rolling and keeping people safer at some level everywhere on the globe on, you know, 6 different continents. We're growing it. But we also realized once the patent came through that we were able to offer this up to organizations for them to integrate into their application. Sure. So we have a university, you know, a university that is already got all their students on the university's application or university's mobile app. We can just link into their, so our technology into their technology, and then they can issue emergency alerts if they need to cause people to make to look at the notification. Airlines, we're working with a couple different airlines about flight cancellations because some of their passengers might want to be notified earlier. Obviously, home security is a perfect illustration for us, where there's lots and lots of different companies that offer home security. They have mobile applications, but if there's water in your basement and because your sump pump has gone out and you're sleeping, most people don't know that. If you could get an audible alert as opposed to just a normal push notification, then you'd wake up and you know what to do. So there's lots and lots of different ways we're going. We've just been, we'll have a press release next week to talk a little bit more about this. And then a press conference in another month for a couple other kind of sort of illustrations of what we're doing. So I won't steal for that, but we are really excited. We offer our solution up for people that don't have applications, they can use our app. And for people that do have applications, we can integrate into theirs. You know, we use location services to crowdsource people.
Yep.
That gives us several benefits. One of those is an SOS button that we provide, which means that if you're in Tanzania and you need emergency services, you may or may not know what the emergency service number is.
Right.
Intelligent, that's our app, it does know that. So you just press SOS and it'll immediately connect you. If you go out to a ski resort, we just were voted one of the top 10 applications that you should have before you go skiing by Telegraph magazine in the UK, or Telegraph newspaper in the UK, because one of the things that we do is when you go out to the ski resort, so whether you're up in Telluride, if you're in Val d'Isère, or you're in Park City, you'll be immediately connected to the Park City resort, which means that if something happens while you're on the mountain, you can either immediately get a call to ski patrol, or they can send you a message saying bad weather is coming in, you need to get off the mountain. And again, these mountains are so big that you need a 30-minute warning to be able to get out. And how else do you get a message to people that are on the mountain when you have no idea who's up there? So that's just some of the illustration. It's crowdsourcing. It's urgent. It's immediate. And it's in their language, which means that if you're getting a message, if you happen to be in France and you're skiing in the Alps and when they're telling you to get off the mountain, you don't need to worry about whether you can speak French. The message will immediately come into your device in English, allowing you to know exactly what's going on so that you can take care, because that's what's most important, getting information to people that they can consume after the authorities figure it out, getting it to their devices, making them look at it, and making them understand it. That's what we do at Intelligent.
Excellent. Well, this has been a really good episode today. I appreciate you taking the time out on a cold Chicago afternoon. do you have any final comments? And more importantly, if whoever's listening to this wants to contact Intelligent or yourself to get more information, how would they get a hold of you, Alan?
Easiest way, thank you. Easiest way is our website. It's www.in-intelligent.com. Hit the contact us. We'll immediately, one of our folks will get right back to you. You know, we're up and running, available right away. But coming back, going through that one last thing, you know, everybody, whether it's our app or their organization's kind of sort of awareness, you know, I really appreciate what you do, Rob. I mentioned this, you know, in our little pre-call. I really appreciate what you and your team are doing, raising the awareness around preparation, raising the awareness around being aware of what's going on before there's a problem is so very, very critical, and it will save lives. So thank you and your team for what you're doing, because this is really, really important, not only to us, but to everybody else.
Yeah, appreciate that feedback. That's very kind of you. And again, thank you very much, and enjoy your weekend, Alan.
I hope you do too, Rob. Thank you.
Yeah, take care. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
That wraps up episode 58 of our podcast series. I encourage you to please rate us on iTunes or any of the other outlets where you're listening to this. Please comment if you're listening to this on our website. We'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening today. Until next time, have a safe and productive day.